Hi, guys. This is your host, Steve Mathis. Before we get started with this lovely edition of the BTOsports.com podcast show brought to you by Trans World Motocross, I just want to put out a shout-out, as they say, the cool kids say, to my own website, pulpmx.com, P-U-L-P-M-X.com. Check it out and, see what you think. As well, follow me on Twitter at pulpmx. So Twitter, pulpmx, website, pulpmx. All right, I'm done with the pimping. Hey, everyone. This is Steve Mathis. Thanks for listening to the podcast show. Before we begin the show, I just wanted to give a little shout-out to my new friends at BTOsports.com. BTOsports.com has teamed up with yours truly to provide you podcast listeners with a cool free deal. What you want to do is go to BTOsports.com and check out all the sweet stuff from Fly Racing, Fuel Graphics, O'Neill, Stella, FMF, Liat, and Vortex. They carry these lines along with pretty much anything else that you need for your bike or body. So you go there. The cool thing is you order more than $100, and really, what's $100 these days? James Stewart has that much in his Lambo ashtray. Anyways, order more than $100. Type in the offer code Mathis, M-A-T-T-H-E-S, in the coupon section right when you're checking out, and you'll get a special deal. It's so special, they haven't even really told me yet what it is. So to recap, go to btosports.com, spend $100, type in Mathis in the coupon section upon checkout, and get some kind of hella super sweet deal. Remember to check out their closeouts at btosports.com as a proud sponsor of the BBMX race team. All right, on to this week's show.
Your brain may explode from listening to this show. We will not be held responsible if it does. What are you going to do about it anyway? You won't have a head. You have been warned.
Welcome to the BTOsports.com podcast show, brought to you by Trans World Motocross, hosted by Steve Mathis.
Welcome to the BTOsports.com Trans World Motocross podcast show. I'm your host, Steve Mathis, but more importantly is my guest. And my guest is none other than, mountain bike racer turned factory mechanic turned trainer turned whatever else, Randy Lawrence. RL, what's going on?
Oh, not much, man. Just getting the kids in bed and just winding down from the day and getting ready to get some sleep, I guess.
Yeah, did I cover all the bases there? What else is there? Mountain biker, mechanic, trainer.
That's pretty much it. Dad, husband, babysitter.
Yeah.
Psychiatrist.
Yeah. Come on. I don't even know where to start with you, man. I've always wanted to do one of these with you, and there's so much to touch on. But I guess first of all, you're training Jason Lawrence. How'd that come about?
Well, the working together with Jason came about. I was talking to Scott Subkovic a little bit through the month of December about some other riders and stuff, and Jason had came up a couple times. Obviously, he was still in jail at the time.
Yeah.
And they didn't really know exactly what was going to happen with him and when he was going to get out and all that kind of stuff. And we never really talked about working with him at all, but just talking with Scott and just doing whatever, he ended up getting released the day before Christmas. So at that point, Scott was like, hey, he wants to race at Anaheim 1, like he wants to get going.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, if that's the case, and he wants to make some changes and do the things that, you know, that he's saying he wants to do, like with his trans world interviews and all that kind of stuff, then maybe we could sit and talk about it. And, so we did, you know, after Anaheim 1. I mean, they kind of went and did their own thing for a couple of weeks, and we didn't touch base. And once he got through Anaheim 1 and, you know, wasn't feeling that great at the race and was kind of feeling tired, we talked a little bit. And I really saw in his eyes and what he was saying that, that he wanted to do things a bit different. He didn't want to get in trouble anymore. He wanted to make changes in his life. You know, he had kind of moved everybody out from from living with him, and just wanted a fresh start and to do things right. And you know, he had a few years of racing that he could do, and didn't want to have any regrets later on. So if somebody's with the skills and talents that he has wants to do that, then, you know, I think it's, you know, only right to kind of give him that opportunity. And he felt I was the guy that could help him do that. So we made an agreement to get started and get into it a little bit and kind of see where it went.
All right.
And we're just about 2 months in now, and you know, he's had some ups and some downs, but working through it.
Right on. Well, good. Yeah, I mean, he's slowly getting better, I think. He's slowly coming around. Didn't race this weekend in Daytona, but, you know, up until then, he'd put in a couple of solid 20-lappers, which is, you know, a starting point for him, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, going from, if you look at his past 6 months as opposed to, you know, everybody else on the starting line, this has been a little bit different than those. And for him to come around and even do a couple of top tens that he's done has been, you know, that just kind of shows the talent and skill that the guy has on a dirt bike.
Right. No, exactly. Now, you're also training Jake Weimer, who's having a dynamite season, man. Talk about working with Jake a little bit.
Jake is awesome. I don't think you're going to get a kid that's going to put more effort in and just do what he needs to do every day. You know, if he's feeling a little bit tired and you tell him to do it anyways, he's going to do it.
Yeah.
But if he's feeling a little bit tired and I say, okay, just kind of take it easy and chill or do this road ride or whatever, you know, he'll just do it. He'll do whatever he needs to do to be that guy that's going to be able to be on the box and ultimately win championships in the end.
Right.
So it's been we're going on 2 years coming up the beginning of the Nationals. So we're a couple months away from 2 years working together. You know, we worked through the Nationals in 08 to just kind of get our feet wet a little bit and kind of see how he dealt with racing. And you know, everybody knew he was fast, you know.
Right.
Speed and lap time, all that was there. He'd already won a Supercross at that point. So just kind of learning him and what his strengths and weaknesses were through that season were crucial for us to get into his first off season when he went to ride for Mitch's team.
Right.
You know, I think we had a great off season and we pinpointed some things that were weaknesses, and, you know, he came out in 09, you know, and he won the first round. You know, he had potential to win the second one. He went down in the sand and he won San Francisco, and, you know, he ended up winning three races that year and came within 5 points of a championship in Supercross that year from where he was at the year before, was huge for him and
right. And
for me. You know, I think, you know, we developed a good relationship, worked well together, and was making good progress. And then, you know, we anticipated carrying that into the Nationals last year, and, you know, we had some bad starts in the beginning. And
he did, yeah.
Was just making some mistakes, and we were kind of scratching our heads a little bit, wondering why the starts weren't there, and, you know, just the little mistakes, like tipping over or just, like, going off the track and just losing a little bit of time here and there, like, throughout a moto. But yet everything during the week was, he was just, like, on it, like, really good. And, you know, all that kind of came to a head at Mount Morris when he was in perfect position to, you know, win or at least be on the box at that race without really doing anything special. And he fell once in the first moto, and, you know, that kind of took the wind out of him, and he was, like, breathing super hard. And then the second moto was kind of the same position, went down when he was in second, got up in sixth, moved back up to fourth, fell again, just couldn't get his bike going and was, like, winded. And, you know, we were kind of scratching our heads. He was really upset. Mitch was kind of wondering what was going on. I was kind of scratching my head a little bit. And, you know, we got some blood work done and got some testing done. Everything came back negative. Like, he was good to go. You know, by Thursday after Mount Morris, they're like, okay, he's good to go. Resume training.
Right.
And, you know, we always try to watch guys' resting heart rates and things like that. And what we thought was his resting, like, he was always really close to that. And then, like I said, that Thursday, they said, go ahead, get back out there, do what you need to do. And, you know, we just kind of talked about it, and I said, look, just take the rest of this week into Monday just off. Don't do anything. And that next Monday, we saw about 4 beats lower on his resting heart rate than he'd ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
So we knew that what we were doing, you know, maybe we weren't, like, completely over doing it, but we were for sure at that red line to where, like, he was always just right there at that border.
Right.
To where he just wasn't going to be able to hold it together under pressure situations or whatever's going on. So, you know, he took off until that Monday, and we rode twice that week and went to Colorado, and he ended up, that was his first national win that he ever had. So, you know, we knew the base was there. We knew all that stuff was there. We were just, you know, kind of running him at that red line, like I said. And once we learned that, we kind of got through that a little bit, and, you know, he ended up winning 3 nationals, you know, through the end of that season, and then being invited to the Nations and, you know, the team winning there. You know, it wasn't the performance he was exactly looking for there, but, you know, we needed his score that he got. So, you know, they won as a team, and it was just great, you know, for me being there 4 years in a row with 2 different riders and having USA win all those times. It's just, it's a really good feeling. That's awesome.
Did you go as a mechanic ever?
No, I never got as a mechanic. You know, the first time I went to the Nations was in 06 with Ryan.
Oh, because I went as a mechanic, and, yeah, we lost. So just thought I'd throw that out there.
No, 06, 07, 08 with Ryan, with Jake.
Well, I didn't really know behind the scenes and what was going on as far as the blood work and all that, but I had my own theory on Jake is that, and it happens a lot, he was locked in that battle for the Supercross title. And, you know, Supercross comes first, and it's a different type of riding. And next thing you know, after Vegas, boom, there's the outdoors. And then, you know, it's a struggle to get back into the outdoor mindset. And then, you know, the week off after Mount Morris, he got into it and he came out and he won. But do you think some of what I think is true? Some of what my theory is? Or do you think it's...
Yeah, no, I think you're right with that. The only exception for him would be we had that 9-week break in Supercross, and he did outdoor testing and riding pretty much that whole time.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And so he was, like, that's what I'm saying, like, outdoor speed, like, if the gnarly tracks that we go to, whatever we were doing outdoor-wise, he was looking like, you know, he was going to be a contender, you know, at least podium spots and, you know, top fives for sure. Like, that wasn't even really,
right,
you know, something that was, that we were, like, thinking, oh, well, if you get a top five, you're doing pretty good.
Right.
You know, he was looking like, I should be a top five guy and, you know, on the podium most of the time. So that was kind of a bummer, but, again, like, we learned through it, and we continued working together, and, you know, we stuck it out, and we went through another off season, and, you know, he really wanted to buckle down and be the guy that's able to put things together for the Supercross series. And, you know, with the exception of Anaheim 3, you know, he's been the guy. Like, you know, Trey Kennard's been riding great. He's had some mistakes. Will Hahn's been riding great. You know, just his starts haven't been quite there the whole time.
Right.
But Jake, you know, he's top 3 or 4 on the starts every time. You know, he's riding good. He's riding good up front. He's riding good from 3rd or 4th. You know, he's able to put together the laps that he needs to be in the position he's at now. And, you know, I believe it's been, you know, not only me and him working together and working together well, but, you know, Mitch's team is behind him, and they got great bikes, and they're always testing and making progress there and, you know, moving the start devices up and down to ensure that the starts are going to be there every time. And,
right.
We really try not to leave any stone unturned. And if we find something there, great. If we don't, well, we know that we looked there and didn't find it. So
yeah. Another bonus to work with Weimer is that I truly believe he's a good kid. He's a good dude. Like, I mean, he's a kid, so, I mean, I'm sure he's doing his fair share of, you know, experiencing being a kid off the track. But I do believe he's a good kid. He's a good dude.
No, he's awesome. Like, he's 22 now, and, you know, he's kind of gone through some of that stuff, but he was never, like, one of those crazy kids that just wanted to get in trouble or,
yeah,
you know, run around with, you know, all these different girls and all that kind of stuff. He's always had a pretty level head, and for him, he's he's always been that kid. He's been fast, but he's always struggled, like, at the races. He's always been the guy that he has to put in the extra effort during the week if he wants to perform well on the weekend.
Yeah.
You know, and that's his goal. Like, he wants to be a champion, so he's not going to let, you know, distractions and things on the side get in the way of that goal for him. So, you know, again, for me, you know, I've been in this industry 20 years, and I've pretty much seen every direct distraction that a kid can have. And
you've had some of those yourself, RL.
Yeah, you know, I've had some of those distractions myself. But, again, you know, like if we see something that's going on, we talk about it. And,
yeah,
you know, he's usually really good to, you know, kind of nip it in the bud. And,
right.
And that's usually not an issue anymore. So, again, like I'm saying, like, you know, the experience that I've been around and, you know, what we're doing together, communicating and the effort he's putting in, the effort the team's putting in, you know, his mechanic, like everybody that's involved.
Yeah.
Sean, Zach, you know, just even other mechanics on the team, like everybody's there just to do everything they can for every one of those riders, just to be the best they can on Saturday.
Yeah, his mechanic, Sean's a good dude. I've known Sean for a long time, since the Moto Triple X days. He's a good guy.
Yeah, Sean's awesome. He just loves being a part of that team and yeah, working with Jake. And obviously, when you're winning races, it just makes everything that much better. And
yeah,
you will put in that extra effort and go to the track and do more of the practice bikes. And, you know, so it's like a snowball effect. If the rider's doing good, everybody's motivated to keep going and push, push, push.
Yeah.
So,
or like in my case, if the rider's just making podiums, you just do the extra work. Not so much work,
well,
but, you know.
Yeah. I mean, And that's the thing. Like, even if they're not winning, it's like if they're putting in everything they can, you're there to put in everything you can. You know, if they're appreciating what you're doing, even if they're a 6th, 7th, 8th place guy, if they're doing everything they can to be the best they can, you know, you're going to put in that effort.
Yeah.
You know, not necessarily winning every week. So.
Who else do you got besides Weimer? Do you have anybody else in your stable? And of course, J-Lo?
Well, yeah, it's kind of been a up and down a little bit for me. Like, I know you're always saying, like, these trainers with the revolving door and stuff. And
yeah, we need to talk about that a little bit.
I feel, you know, I've been pretty stable with what I do, and obviously there's amateur kids that want help, and, you know, I've helped a few different amateur kids along the way, and I always try to have, like, two, you know, high-pro, like, top-level, like, 450 rider and a lights rider that can kind of work together and do things together and push each other, and that kind of makes things better for me, and I try to be really hands-on with my guys, so I can't have 6, 7, 8, 10 guys. I mean, I got three or four max. So for me, that revolving door doesn't really work because, you know, you can't just have three guys and have that revolving door and, you know, continue, you know, being able to pay your bills and things like that. So
yeah.
So on that side, like, I mean, me and Villapoto, we were together for, you know, we were just coming up on 4 years. And unfortunately, we weren't, you know, continuing on at that point. But I'd been with Jake for, it had been a year at that point, and he was making good progress. He was happy with the success that we were having at that time together. So we continued working together. Now we're going on 2 years. But since Ryan had left, you know, it's kind of been a little bit up and down for me. You know, I started working with a couple amateur kids, and that was going really well. They decided that, you know, they didn't really want to continue working with me if I was going to help Jason. So,
really? You lost a couple of clients because of that?
Yeah, I did. And that was a tough thing for me. And, you know, I felt that, you know, the way that I lead my life and the way that I'm positive and upbeat and the progress that my riders make, you know, I thought that would be enough to be like, okay, well, let's see where this goes. And, you know, if it's not working well, then, you know, maybe we'll do something else. But, you know, they made the choice to go ahead and move on and do something else. And, you know, that's their choice. And I'm okay with that. You know, I'm still really good friends with the whole family. So there's no hard feelings there at all.
Right.
And then, like right when Ryan left, I started with a Kyle Cunningham also. And we were having a great relationship. Things were going really good. We, you know, really good with the entire family.
Mm-hmm.
Kyle was making good progress. You know, he was working on just things at the races that, you know, he's more mentally than actual speed and riding wise.
Yeah, he's definitely fast. Yeah, Kyle strikes me as a rider that's got the speed. He crashes, he tips over, he has some mental problems.
Yeah, just little mental stuff here and there. And
yeah.
And, you know, again, we were working on that stuff, and he was making progress through the Nationals. He ended up with a second place in a moto at Washougal. You know, the season from that point didn't go as well as planned.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up, honestly, like, we tried to stick it out through the off season with, you know, him losing his ride from Canada, and he went to Australia and rode Yamahas down there, and he did well down there. And came back, and there was just nothing here for him. Like,
yeah.
Nobody offered him a ride, and so obviously he wasn't getting a salary or anything, and he ended up moving back to Texas, and that's kind of what happened to our relationship.
Yeah.
So
he's been struggling a little bit too this year on a new team, on the Honda team.
Yeah, I mean he kind of got that the Tisco Honda team was kind of the last minute thing, and
right.
You know they sounds like they're putting good effort into their bikes, and their bikes seem pretty fast, and you know they got a good track and gym facility and things like that out in Texas, and I know coming up to the first couple East Coast rounds, we had a lot of rain and a lot of snow and just didn't have
right.
a lot of time to ride and put a lot of time on the bike because, I mean, we were out here racing Anaheim 1, Phoenix, Anaheim 2, you know, San Francisco, he still didn't even have a dirt bike to ride.
Oh, really?
Since he got back from Australia, which was the beginning of December, so he was a... He's kind of, you know, a little bit behind the eight ball just coming in. And, you know, if you look at Indy to Atlanta, he made some good progress and did a little bit better. And then even from Indy to Daytona, like,
yeah.
I thought he rode a pretty good race in Daytona. His speed was good. He got a pretty good start in his heat race. He showed that he could run right there with a couple of guys. And then, again, he made a couple of mistakes and went back to fourth in the heat race. But,
yeah,
you know, he's coming around. He's a kid. He likes to work hard and puts in a lot of effort and, you know, all the things that, you know, somebody like myself is looking for in a person. So,
right. As much as you want to get into what happened with you and RV, certainly from the outside, looked to be a pretty successful partnership. What went down there, and you know, we can segue that into my whole rider switching trainers things.
Okay. Honestly, there wasn't a whole lot of communication when a lot of that went down.
Mm-hmm.
Like Ryan, you know, obviously he was very successful on the Lights bike, and, you know, his expectations getting on the 450 from everybody around were huge. And but me and him and his parents would talk, like, the whole time. It's like, okay, let's get on the 450. Let's not overdo expectations. Let's look at, you know, being around the podium and getting on there as many times as possible. If the opportunity arises to win a race, then you take it. But to go in expecting to beat James and Chad when they were riding like they were at that point, you know, that's biting off a big chunk, you know.
Right.
That's kind of that's setting yourself up for failure. You know, if that comes and that's what happens, then that's great. But, you know, you want to learn how to ride that thing for 20 laps. You want to know how to ride it through the pack. You want to know how to race with Kevin Windham and race with Ivan Tedesco. I mean, you got to learn how to race with guys that have been doing it longer than, you know, the 5 through 12 riders in the Lights class.
Right.
I mean, those guys are going to make more mistakes and things like that. You know, you look at 5 through 12 in the Supercross class, they're pretty solid. You know, if they're going to do lap time, they're going to do the whole time.
Right.
And they're not going to let you by. So, you know, we really went into it looking at it as a learning year. And, you know, he had a couple crashes early on, and then he came out in Houston and, you know, stood on the podium even after falling in the main event. You know, James passed him. He passed him back. James passed him, like, in the next corner, but, you know, kind of showed that he's, like, there, kind of throw it in there a little bit if he can. And,
right.
And he had another podium at San Francisco, which was great. He had another podium in Atlanta. You know, he had took a hard hit at Anaheim 3. And wasn't able to race the main because he crashed in his heat race and kind of dinged his head a little bit. And,
right.
You know, we used the doctors and everybody that we needed to make sure he was able to race San Diego, which he came from pretty far back up to fourth and, you know, put in a good effort there and possibly could have been on the podium pretty easily with a little bit better start. So, I mean, I was looking at it like we were making, decent games and learning a lot at that time. And then he ended up getting sick, and we didn't really think too much of it because it was just kind of a little bit of a flu or whatever. And then he got better the next week and felt fine. And then he got sick again right away, like another 5 days later. So the first thing I did is send him in to get blood work done.
Right.
And they saw that, like, his monocytes were really high and his white blood cell count was low, and one thing led to another, and next thing you know, like, he had mono. Like, one of the doctors said he had it, and another doctor said, well, he might have it, but maybe it's not.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, whatever he had, it was a viral infection that he needed to rest.
Right.
Like, he just needed to rest to let his body heal up. And we did that. You know, we did what we needed to do for the few weeks, and we actually started training again and had been riding and doing what we needed to for about 2 weeks before he was going to race again. And then, like Easter, I texted him to find out what tracks he wanted to ride that week. And he said he said he didn't care and just wanted to meet with me. He had some things to talk about before we went to the track, and I met up with him, and he just kind of told me that he was going to move on and use somebody else. And
that kind of came out of the blue a little bit, huh?
Yeah, so it kind of came out of the blue. I knew there was people that were a little bit upset about, you know, him getting mono and, you know, whether it was my fault or, you know, it's a virus and anybody can get it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I guess it was kind of put on me that, you know, he was overtraining and doing too much, and that was my fault, that I really didn't know what I was doing. And so they just kind of moved forward at that point. And, you know, that was a tough pill to swallow for sure. I mean.
But everything I hear about RV is that he's not going to do too much. He has to be pushed. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, he works hard, don't get me wrong, but he needs somebody pushing him. So,
he does need somebody. I mean, at least to the point, you know, from when he was 16 when I started with him until, you know, last year at this point, you know, he needed to be pushed. He needed to be like, okay, we're going to go out, we're going to do 20 lap, or we're going to do a couple of heat races. You know, we're going to go on this road ride, and we need to put in effort from this point to this point. You know, he wasn't just going to get on this road bike and go out and put in 80 miles just because he wanted to.
Right.
But that's why he has, you know, a trainer. That's why he had me.
Because
he just was, he was going to do what he needed to do, whatever he was told to do, and he did. I mean, he was awesome at all that. You know, he wasn't in the best mood every single time we went to Central or somewhere like that, but
yeah.
You know what? He got on his bike and he did it.
Yeah.
And he kept his lap times where he needed to. And when he started slipping a little bit, we would have a little bit of a talk and a chat and, you know, what are your goals? This is what it's going to take to have you be able to reach those. And he would get out there and he would do it. And, you know, it was awesome to work with him. And I think some of what maybe transpired is I started with him when he was 16.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at that point, I was 38 years old. So I still worked with him and treated him the same the last year I was working with him as I did the first year.
Right.
And at that point, he was 20 years old, and I'm 41. So my life didn't change much, but from 16 to 20, your life changes huge.
Yeah, no, exactly.
No, and that's kind of me not paying attention and, you know, him growing and going through the things and stuff that he did with his parents and, you know, getting a girlfriend and moving out of the house and all that kind of stuff. I was still trying to treat him like he was that 16-year-old kid, and that kind of probably was a little bit of it too. Like, he wasn't the greatest communicator with his feelings and things like that. When I look back on it, that could have some of the stuff to do with it too.
Do you think that maybe some people, parents, Cowie, were upset about you for the mono, for overtraining? I mean, was that when you alluded to people getting upset? Is that kind of who was?
I mean, obviously there's people that are in his corner that want to see him be successful.
Yeah.
And, you know, the only thing that I had a little bit of issue was there wasn't a whole lot of communication. It wasn't like somebody pulled me in the meeting and said, okay, what's going on?
Right.
Like, why is he like this? Like,
right.
Really trying to figure out what was going on, you know. So whether it was Cowie or his parents or him or whoever, it had to be like that group of people that we've always worked with close together.
Yeah.
That just decided, look, you know, he had a good run. He got sick. It's his fault. You know, maybe he doesn't really know what he's doing, so let's try to get somebody else.
That's kind of where I have the worst issues at. Yeah, but despite the 3.5 years of nothing but success. It's funny how that works. Now, how was it with Weimer and RV? Because they're buddies. So how'd that all go down, and how was that?
And, you know, that made it a little bit tough at first. Like,
right.
You know, mentally for Jake, that might have been a little bit tough, like right at that point where he had to come back to Seattle and do that stuff. And, again, like, for me, I try to keep my riders separate with what I'm doing with them, what I'm trying to do, you know, as far as mentally. Like, obviously, they got to ride. They got to ride road bikes. They got to go to the gym, do all that stuff. Like, that's pretty much every rider out there, but they're all mentally different, so you try to treat them as an individual. And so I do think that was a little bit tough for Jake because, like I said, I like to have a 450 guy and a lights guy. And when, you know, Ryan was getting to the point where he was moving up to the 450, he was involved with what we were trying to do and getting a lights guy. And there was a couple of lights guys that we had talked to and, you know, been involved with a little bit, you know, to kind of bring on board and start working with together so they have somebody ride together and do their road rides together and all that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Jake, between all of us, was the guy that we kind of chose. Like, you know, it wasn't just me and Ryan either. Like Mitch was involved. We talked to him and Ryan's parents, you know, Jake's parents, or his dad, and, you know, Jake himself, you know, just everybody that was involved.
Right.
We talked about it and made sure that was going to be a good fit. So... So that's kind of where that went.
Right. Kind of weird, completely coincidental, but kind of weird how you and RV separate. He gets Jeff Spencer. He wins that next weekend in Seattle. Seattle. He breaks up with Jeff Spencer this year, gets Darren Stockton, and wins that weekend. I mean, completely coincidental, but it is funny, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty wild. And again, like, Ryan, he's a great rider, and he's always going to be successful at what he does. I mean, he's worked really hard to get where he was at. You know, we knew, you know, I really felt we were doing the right things to get him in a position where if the opportunity was there to win a race, he was going to be able to do it. He would be able to close the deal. And, I mean, unfortunately for me, you know, he won Seattle under, like, everything that we had been building up.
Yeah.
So obviously, he did get sick, and he was down for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks. But when he came back, you know, that was the base that we had built. And he's the one on the dirt bike, and he's the one putting in the effort and, you know, having the good sprint laps and putting 20 laps together and the whole deal. But I felt it was a package that we had developed together. You know, he was able to do that on the 450. And, you know, although it was hard for me because I knew that he had let me go, it was still very satisfying because
right.
You know, I knew that we had done the right job and that he was going to continue to be successful. And then he won, you know, Las Vegas that year.
Yeah.
You know, Chad and James had a little bit of pressure and things going on with them, but, I mean, you can't take anything away from the way Ryan rode the 450 that night. I mean, he was on rails.
Yeah.
It was awesome. It was awesome to watch. So, you know, unfortunately, he ended up dinging his knee and not being able to ride the Nationals after going 1-1 at the first round.
And looking every part like he'd be the guy all summer, you know, with that ride. That was a phenomenal ride.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and then he did have Jeff, and he went with him through the off season and all that kind of stuff. And again, I mean, we're all at the Kawasaki track, and we ride at Ryan's house, and, you know, so I've been with him at the track, really, you know, since he started riding again,
mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, sharing pit boards with Jeff Spencer while he's working with him and the whole deal. And like I said, you know, it was a little bitter pill to swallow at first, but, you know, people make choices and they move on and do different things for different reasons, and I'm okay with that. So there was no hard feelings or anything, so we just kind of worked together, and, you know, if I saw him struggling in areas, you know, I'd even talk to him about it.
Yeah, would you? And he was open? He was cool?
Yeah, he was open with it, and, you know, it was maybe a little bit awkward at first, but, you know, seemed to come around, and, you know, we talk a little bit now and see each other, but, I mean, obviously now he's in Florida, but, like, when he was here up until
right.
Indy, Jake was riding at his house, you know, once, maybe twice a week, so
right.
We were over there quite a bit, and you know, it was kind of tough watching Ryan at the first few rounds, you know, kind of getting tired and going backwards a little bit and just struggling. And when you know what potential's in there.
Right.
So we even talked a little bit through some of that stuff, and, you know, maybe the conversations weren't perfect or whatever. Like, maybe he thought I was being a little hard on him or happy that he wasn't being that successful because of the choice he made or whatever, which wasn't that or wasn't. It's like, I don't know.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, obviously he doesn't like getting beat. You know, it doesn't matter if it's Josh Hill or if it's Dungy or if it's James or whoever it is. He doesn't like getting beat. So he knows what he needs to do. He knows he has a good sprint. He knows how to be aggressive. He knows how to push through the jumps. And, you know, he's got a guy with him now in Darren who he's been around the sport for a long time. And he can go to Florida with him when he needs to. He can be here when he needs to. And, you know, he's doing what he needs to do to win races right now. And he's going to continue to do that. Like, he's not going to, you know, let somebody beat him and then just be like, whatever. You know, he's going to go a little bit harder the next time. You know, and with Atlanta, I mean, he for sure could have, like, settled and been a second, no problem. But that's not Ryan. Ryan doesn't settle when he's a second and a half off of somebody.
Yeah, no, for sure. He just pushes harder. I think it's a credit to everybody's professionalism because, let's face it, I mean, RV could have been whispering in Jake's ear, hey, you know, you got to get rid of him. He's no good. And he wasn't. And Jake wasn't thinking, oh, man, RV got rid of RL. I better get rid of him, too. You know what I mean? And you're professional. It smacks that everybody took the high road a little bit and worked it out, you know?
Yeah. That's kind of what was cool about it. You know, I talked to Jake a lot through the whole thing. You know, he was pretty pumped. Like, he knew that I helped him with some things on the mental side of it, with, like, once the gate dropped, I mean, he was able to do a better job with his racing than he was before, and he felt that I helped him with that side of it.
Right.
You know, obviously he was on Mitch's team, and a lot of great things are going on there, but, again, I think it's a whole package. It's a whole team effort and everybody working together, you know, and I'm with him every day, so, you know, I'm helping him with his weaknesses and talking to him about what happened on a race weekend before, why he made that mistake, or does he know why he made it, or whatever. And he felt he was in a position where he was winning races because I was there helping him be able to do that. You know, not necessarily that it was 100% me, but I was a part of that. So, and he was happy to be there because he had been on the other side of it where he put in all this effort all the time and wasn't winning. Well, now he was in a position to win races, so he didn't want to upset what was going on.
Yeah, and it's like you said, it's a snowball, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
What's your take on the trainers in our sport? I mean, I'm just going to be honest with you. Some people would look at you and say, what does he know? He was a mechanic and a mountain bike racer. Somebody would look at Jeff Spencer and say, oh, that guy's got it going on because he works with Lance Armstrong. And I'm not saying Jeff doesn't. I'm saying there's a wide variety of, you know, Ryan Hughes, you know, seems to go through a lot of clients. He's an ex-pro racer at a high level. Like, what's your take on all the different trainers, all the different backgrounds, the techniques, and all that in our sport? And obviously, I don't want you to badmouth anybody or nothing like that. Just what do you think?
Well, I mean, you're right. I mean, it's kind of a new thing to our sport, you know. Well, it's getting into it now, but, you know, Ricky's kind of the one that started bringing trainers in and getting on strict regimen programs and to where, like, every single weekend he was good. Like, if he had a bad day, nobody knew it. You know, and that's kind of the approach I take with my riders. If you have a bad day, I don't want anybody to know it but you. So I think what I can bring to the table, I mean, like you said, everybody has something that they do great, and I feel that Jeff Spencer has a lot to offer, you know, different riders. Maybe he offers them a little bit different things than I do that are better than what I do, but I do feel I have a pretty good package. I did race some.
I think you just need some more machines, RL.
Some more machines, yeah.
Some more machines.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I don't have any of those.
You need machines.
whenever we when one of my guys get hurt, we borrow somebody's game ready and we ice it up. So
yeah. No, but anyway, sorry to interrupt you there, but yeah.
Yeah, that's all right. But no, I just felt like, yeah, I mean, I did race mountain bikes for a little while, but when I did that, you know, we did a lot of cross training and we had a trainer that worked with our team that kind of taught me a lot about heart rate zones and building a base and doing intervals and sprints and being able to, you know, do what we needed to do efficiently, you know, and being more comfortable doing it at the same pace as we would if we were just, like, hyperventilating.
Mm-hmm.
So learning a lot of that over the 4 years that I raced mountain bikes, then obviously being in the motocross industry since, like, 89, 90, you know, I've seen pretty much every ex-rider and current rider come through the ranks.
And your including your own brother. Let's not forget about Factory Phil.
Yeah, including Phil, like watching him come through and seeing, you know, what he did right, what he did wrong. You know, even down to, like, Damon Bradshaw, the things he did good, the things he did bad. Doug Dubach, I worked with him for, you know, a couple of years. You know, David Pingree, a couple of years. You know, I worked really close beside Jeff Emig for a while, even when he won his very first championship. To, you know, I was working with Jeremy when we took Jeff's last number one plate away. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, I've seen a lot of ups and downs in this industry. You know, working with Jeremy for 3 years, I learned a lot about the mental side of somebody that is there to win championships. You know, working with other riders and, you know, being close to, like, the Buddy Antonezes and, you know, like my brother and Emig and Jimmy Button and,
right.
You know, even through the years at Kawasaki with James Stewart and Nasrul Lusk and Michael Byrne and just everybody that has raced, you know, amateur or pro and been successful or haven't been successful, you know, I've seen the mistakes they've made. I've seen how they've come through the ranks. I've seen how the parents have dealt with them, how they've dealt with their parents, how, you know, maybe they went astray for a little while and came back, you know, and I pull from all of those areas that I've seen, you know, whether they're good or bad, and I apply those to what, you know, my riders are dealing with it at different points in their career.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so that's a lot of, like, the mental side and the race side of it. And then obviously working with training with, for the mountain bikes and all that kind of stuff, learning all that,
that
you know, that's, that's where I get, like, that's why I use the bicycle a lot because that's what I learned mm-hmm. on. So I know how to use that to build the base or build VO2 max or any of those kinds of things.
Right.
But I also understand what it takes to race 30-minute plus two at a national and then have an hour and a half break and have to do it again, even if it's 103 degrees, right. You know, or whatever it takes at the races. I kind of understand that. And so I apply whatever training techniques we do on the bicycle or at the gym or whatever so that they can do that well on Saturday, you know, because they don't need to be a cyclist.
Yeah.
They need to be.
There's a lot of cyclists, cycle trainers in our industry, huh? Like, do you feel that crosses over well? Is that why it works?
Well, I think it can cross over well
mm-hmm.
if it's applied correctly.
Right.
You know, if you're just coming in from being a cyclist or a trainer for cyclists and you decide, okay, I need these motocross riders to be doing 70 miles on their road bikes 3 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little bit unnecessary. So, you know, maybe the riders are going to get burned out. They're going to kind of be over it, maybe overtrain a little bit. Maybe they'll be a little bit flat and maybe lose that little bit of a spark or a fire that they had. You know, their sprint's not going to be quite as good. But, I mean,
mm-hmm.
so, I mean, I try to look at all of those different things. And, again, I'm not the perfect guy that's just going to make everybody a champion. I believe that I can help a rider reach their potential.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to take a little bit of time. It ain't going to happen overnight.
Right.
And that's how I feel like working with Ryan for 4 years, if you look at it, if you watch different races over the seasons, you'll see, you know, the development and steps that he made where he got better and better and better. Like, he was incredible in 07 when he raced against Townley.
Mm-hmm.
But he learned a lot there, and he was even better on the motorcycle, more efficient, faster, more comfortable doing things that he did in 08.
Right.
You know, so he just kept developing and getting better and better. And Jake, I feel the same way. And I don't think Jake's even reached his potential yet. So he's continuing to get better and better and better. You know, just he's more comfortable going the pace that he's going now. His heart rate's lower. You know, before when we would do sprint laps, you'd just kind of make mistakes and run off berms and
right.
over jump stuff. And now, like, his moto laps look real similar to what his sprint laps are. So
I think the greatest compliment someone could pay you is the fact that, I mean, RV came into the pro ranks as a highly decorated amateur, but he wasn't all that. He wasn't a Mike Alessi or even a Barsha or whatever. And I don't think, I mean, he's on the verge of being one of the greatest riders of all time, at least in a lights class, I think he was, or close to it. And, you know, you made him into that, or you helped him. You helped turn him into that. That's a compliment. Anybody can train Carmichael and Stewart. You know what I mean? So,
and again, I mean, I don't like to just toot my horn or whatever, but
right.
you know, I do feel that I helped Ryan develop into the racer that he is. Like, he's a great rider. He had great talent. He had great success as an amateur. But Mike Alessi was always that little bit better in the amateur stuff. So, what I think was good for Ryan, he already knew how to lose races.
Yeah,
and that's. If you win everything as an amateur and you come into the pro stuff and you're not winning, that's tough to take.
Yeah.
Like, you really don't know what to do at that point.
No.
So, and if you look at Ryan's development, like 06, he had a great year, but it wasn't what his next couple of years were. You know, right. He won one race in the Supercross that year, you know. But he had potential to win a couple more, but he made the rookie mistakes and kind of did the same thing he did his first 450 year in 09. So,
right.
But like you were saying, like, you know, he developed to where, you know, like you were saying, James Stewart and Carmichael, when they came in, they were 4 or 5 seconds a lap faster than everybody else on the track.
Right.
So for them to not win a race, they had to make some big mistakes. If you look at Ryan, even his last year riding the Nationals on a lights bike, he'd be third, fourth, fifth fast at a lot of races.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he wasn't like head and heels above everybody speed-wise every single weekend. He was probably fastest in practice, like pole position guy, 5 or 6 of the 12 Nationals we had.
Right.
But yet, he won 17 motos in a row.
Did he really? Did he win that many in a row?
Yeah. Jason Lawrence won the first moto at Glen Helen.
Yeah.
Ryan won the next 17 motos straight.
Did he really?
Okay. And then Dungey won the second moto at
Washougal. That's right. Okay. All right.
So,
it's funny how that seems so long ago, but it really wasn't.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago.
No.
So, but again, I mean, he was in a position. He did the work. He had the bite. He had the team. You know, he had everything there. That when the gate dropped, he put in 30 minutes plus two, and he didn't make mistakes. He got good starts, and he was right there. If he got a bad start, he had the sprint they needed. He had the surges he needed. He had whatever he needed to not make mistakes and be the guy at the front by the end every time. And that's really, really tough to do, especially when, you know, other riders have lap times that are real similar to yours.
Right.
It's that time. Time for a commercial. Sorry, guys. Got to pay the bills.
Thanks for listening to the BTOsports.com podcast show. Please don't forget that BTO is the world leader in aftermarket motocross parts for the bike or body. You'll find deals like a Shoei VFXW helmet for $309.99, 45% off, or Smith Piston goggles for $32.99, 65% off. Your order can be shipped anywhere in the USA for free, or if you're not in the USA, we ship worldwide. Check it out at BTOsports.com.
So what do you think about the trainer jumper that is going around in our sport? You know, I can think of Josh Grant, Brock Hepler, Ryan Villopoto, Andrew Short. I can think of a lot of guys that have jumped around trainers. What happens? Is it a lot of times the rider just looking for something? I mean, because the bottom line is, no matter, I mean, how good of a trainer you are, if the dude's not putting the work in, then it's not going to happen. So what's your take on that?
Yeah, as far as, like, everybody jumping around, it's really kind of hard to say. I mean, for me, I like to stick with the same riders because I feel like we're developing, you know, over seasons.
Right.
You know, continuing with the same guy, you're kind of going to continue to develop and make the gains. I feel maybe some of the guys jump around. Well, okay, I've learned everything I can learn from this guy. It's time to get this guy and figure out what he's got.
Yeah.
Now it's time to get this guy and figure out what he's got.
Right.
You know, get this guy, figure out what he's got. And if you're doing that, you're always changing your program, and you're going to be racing a little bit different with each one of those guys. So I don't feel you're going to just continue to make the gains that you've been making. You might stop for a little while and maybe go backwards a little bit and then maybe accelerate a little bit, mm-hmm. you know, with another guy. But I think if you stick with a guy and you learn what he's trying to develop in you, then you'll probably have a little bit more success. I was really kind of shocked. And obviously, I don't know the inside scoop when Trey and Greg split up or whatever. I thought they were doing great together. I mean, you know, again, just like me and Ryan, I thought we were doing great together. But so I don't really know what happened inside that.
Each case is separate.
The training side of this industry, it's different than any other part. Like if you're a mechanic, then you work for a team. You know, there's a base salary, like what guys get as a mechanic, and you work for the team. You go to the shop every day. You do that thing that you need to do. You know, and it's a lot of work, and it's really, really hard to do. No, I mean, I did it for 15 years, so
right.
It's tough. It's a really tough job, and you really got to love motocross to do it. And you're going to do it for, you know, about a base salary, what everybody gets.
Yeah.
You're going to, and you kind of know the job. You know what you need to do as far as, like, the training side of it. You know, it's kind of whatever you bring to the table. Like, for me, you know, I tell my riders, okay, this is what I can offer you.
Right.
You know, I can offer you, like, the mental side of things, helping you be better when the gate drops. You know, I'm going to watch you at the races and figure out what we need to work on during the week. I'm going to be with you, you know, 2-3 days a week at the track. I'll be with you on our road rides. I'll be with you at the gym. You know, I'm doing the road rides. I'm working out with them. You know, I'm a part of what they're doing. And I think that brings us closer together. We have a good relationship. You know, it's hard to keep it 100% business because to help them be a great racer, you kind of need to be in their personal business a little bit because
you
have to know what's going on there so they can have a clear mind mentally and know what they need to do on the weekend and just be clear to do that. So,
yeah. See, I feel that's where I would fail as a trainer, is I wouldn't do the cycling with the rider, and I wouldn't do the gym work. So I think, like, that's where my weakness would be.
your weakness might be there. Well, yeah. What you could do is you could email him. You can email him and say, okay, I need you to be on your bike.
That would be more my program. But hey, let me ask you a question about our dear friend Nick Way. You trained him for many years. What happened to Nick Way?
Nick?
I love him. I love him. You love him. You know?
In the pits. You can go talk to him, and I was going to say he's the same dude all the time, but there are times when he ain't in the best mood, but
mm-hmm.
that's pretty easy to read when he's not in the best mood.
Right.
But Nick's great. Like, Nick is going to put in effort. He's going to try hard. If he starts 20th, he ain't going to quit. If he starts second, he ain't going to quit. You know, him getting the whole shot at San Diego was awesome for me to see.
Right.
Now, when I was working with him, you know, he was the guy that's like, he could start 12th and get 7th. Like, that was his deal. He's always going to move forward.
Yeah, yeah. No, I tell people this. The guy's a hard worker. He doesn't quit. He puts in 100% effort. But it wasn't too long ago that he was making podiums in supercrosses.
Yeah, the first year that I worked with him, you know, we did a lot of different things. You know, we changed his – he was always a hard trainer. But we changed his direction in training a little bit. You know, instead of doing, like, way, way, way a lot of stuff at 80%, you know, we cut his training back, and he did less at 100%.
Uh-huh.
So his intensity got a little bit better. And, you know, he started feeling like he wanted to be up front a little bit more. And then, you know, mentally we just had to kind of break him through that the point where it's like, okay, I want to get a start and see what happens. You know, the first time he got a whole shot, you know, he almost led a lap and James got him. Then he was in second for 9 laps, and then he ended up getting 4th or 5th. He was racing with, you know, Ernesto for that spot.
Right.
And he came in and he said, that's the hardest race I've ever ridden in my life. you know, it was the same 20 laps.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That he'd done for 10 years.
Yeah.
But he did it from the front, and that's a really, really tough place to be if you haven't been there before.
Right.
So, you know, as that season went on, he got a little bit more comfortable being in that top five spot, you know, off the starts, and was racing with those guys a little better. His intensity was a little bit better. And it was just so, so cool to see somebody with that big of a heart being successful and how happy that made him.
Right.
To be like top privateer, and you won the truck, and it was just good. Like, it's awesome. And, I mean, obviously you have your bad days and, you know, your bad races, and then you got to wake up on Monday and face each other and go through another week, and you get through that a little bit, and you do your road ride, and it's kind of quiet for a little while, and then you come out of your shell, and then you're over being bummed out, and then you move on.
Right. Well, I just, I still like the guy, and I think he gives it a good effort. I want to see him do a little better, to be honest, you know, the last few years.
I talked to him last week. You know, I'm just, you know, he kind of put a team together for the season and then kind of got thrown into the Kawasaki thing. And,
yeah,
you know, I think he's done a great job there. He's a great guy. He's got a huge fan base.
He does, yeah. You know, yeah.
Tries really hard. He's been getting better starts. He's been finishing 3, 4, 5 positions better each week than he was, you know, before. So, I mean, I think for Kawasaki, he's doing a great job. And I told him that the other day. I mean, I love the effort he's putting in. You know, he's trying harder, you know, in the races. Not that he didn't try hard before, but he has a little bit more flair now,
right.
You know, since he's under that truck and on that bike and stuff. And then to see Chad on the track this last weekend and Nick still riding out of the truck, that was cool. That
yeah.
was really cool for me to see that Kawasaki didn't just kind of bump him out.
Yeah.
Because Dad came back, even though he only rode practice.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. I'm with you. Performance enhanced. We're going to skip along here. We haven't even got to your career yet, RL, as a mechanic, and we're 53 minutes in. But performance enhancing drugs, it's a question that I get a lot. Like, believe it or not, people are asking me about performance enhancing drugs, but I get a lot of it from fans and questions. What's your take on it in our sport? Are they out there? Are they rampant? I did one of these with Trey Kinnear, and he said, so many people are doing them. And I did one of these with Johnny O'Mara, and he said, no one's doing them. They're too expensive. What's your take?
Well, honestly, I don't know how expensive they are, but
yeah,
I'm sure there's people out there using them.
Yeah. They don't test for them, right? I mean, they don't. The AMA or FIM doesn't really test for them, so.
Well, you know what they do? They're using WADA testing now, which is the same as the UCI. Same as the UCI uses, so I'm sure, you know, if guys were using it before,
mm-hmm.
maybe they're a little more careful now. But that's kind of, you know, my question about this industry is do the guys that are using it really know what they're doing with it and
right.
what type enhancements are they using?
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many different kinds that do different things with your body that help in different areas. You know, I wouldn't even know where to start. You
yeah.
know, I raced downhill for 4 years, and I was just kind of a caveman coming into it, where I just rode my bike every day and rode as hard as I could, and that was my training. You know, we had a trainer, and I started developing a little bit more of what I needed to do, you know, the last couple of years into it, but you know, in cycling, it's like they got doctors that monitor, you know, each guy's levels, you know, on a weekly basis or daily basis or, you know, their training camps or whatever they do. And
right.
And I know they spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on these doctors to make sure their riders are running at their optimum potential. So for somebody in this industry to be doing that, you know, I think it's kind of silly anyways, because look at the variables that motocross has compared to the Tour de France.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, Tour de France, you sit in the pack and you need to be strong. Like when it comes to the hills, you got to be able to throw down.
Right.
Now, if you look at motocross, it's not that straightforward. You know, it starts, it's bumps on the track, it's crashing, it's,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's a lot more thrown into it.
Different times to sprint.
Yeah. And I'm not taking anything away from cycling. It's gnarly. Like,
yeah.
I watch the Tour de France, you know, from start to finish every single day. I love it. I love riding my road bike.
Right.
But I think performance-enhancing drugs are for sure going to help you more doing cycling than it's going to do for you in motocross.
Yeah.
You could have a 72 VO2 max, and doesn't mean you're going to beat James Stewart because he has a 56.
Right.
You know, and I'm not saying, I don't know if that's what James's is. Yeah, I'm just kind of throwing out the, as an example.
Right, right. No, we got you. What kind of stuff with, like, HGH, and would they, do they still, like, take your blood out and store it to give it more oxygen and put it back into you? Is that still kind of the stuff going on, like, at the cycling levels, or do you even?
Well, that's kind of the stuff you hear, like, you know, a couple of years ago, the guys were getting busted for blood doping, and that would be, like, taking the blood out and storing it, and, you know, you're doing all your heart efforts, and then you put fresh blood in that's got all the white blood cells and red blood cell counts are really high, and it's thick, it's just full of the juice that you need to be fresh for the next day.
Right.
You know, you hear that stuff going on. You hear about EPO. You hear about HGH a lot.
I do. I hear HGH stuff on Moto end of it from different people, which is, you know, human growth hormone. Helps you recover from injuries and things like that. Do you think that's prevalent?
And again, like, I wouldn't, I mean, I'm sure that there's guys out there using it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if you told me to write a list down of who I think's on it, I wouldn't even know where to start.
Yeah, no, I'm not getting anywhere near that. I just want your opinion on it. Just like Trey Canars was like, dude, everybody's on it, and then O'Meara was like, nobody's on it. And I'm not going to be naive and believe that nobody's on it. You know, there's too much money, too much stuff going on in our sport, but you know, it's out there. But just a matter of...
Well, and I know there was people convinced that I had Ryan using some stuff, and, you know, I mean...
Oh, really?
Honestly, I don't know enough about it to even know where to begin.
Right.
You know, we rode our road bikes a lot. You know, we did a lot of motos. We rode at Central. He rode hard. You know, he did the things they needed to do. And
yeah. I mean, supplements and stuff like that, I'm sure you have your guys on, but that's all...
Yeah, we use sport drinks and protein powders and, you know, amino acids and... You know, things like that, but
all
that's to, you know, just recover from your daily rides and doing what you're doing, and watching your resting heart rate and trying to watch your diet and, you know, eating kind of the right things. You know, and I don't even get all crazy with that. Like, I'm not one of the gluten-free guys that you can't ever, you know, have a soda, or, you know, you can't get a piece of cake after you eat dinner at Claim Jumper or whatever. You know, if you're doing the work that you need to, and again, this is motocross. If you weigh 172 and you're not 168, doesn't mean you're going to lose.
Yeah.
You know?
We were talking about that. Sorry to interrupt you, but we were talking about that the other day. There's been champions that have been like Damon Huffman, where there's nothing to them. And there's been champions like Barnett, short, stocky, muscular guy. There is no body type in moto. You could be successful no matter what.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, the only thing that I would say about the, you know, the Damon Huffman type is that's the guy that I would have eating a lot more calories, so he can put on a little bit.
Right.
And also that, you know, when we do work out, you know, he's not just eating that muscle up when he goes on a road ride or something. Mm-hmm. You know, he's able to sustain that because he put some calories in his body, so that he can build that muscle, so if he does have a good get-off, that he's not just going to fall apart every single time. So,
right.
Yeah, it's hard to take a guy that's really lean. Like Jake, when I started with him, was like 4.7 or something body fat. And now he's, you know, the last time we had him checked was he was like 7.5. So he'd gained about 3%. And he'd gained some muscle. And, you know, so I know that we're headed in the right direction with that.
Right. And MC was never a picture of fitness in the day, you know?
No, he was never too worried about being too lean. You know, he always had the reserves for when he had to ride nationals and that kind of stuff. But you know what? When I started working with him, when he switched over to the Yamahas, I mean, he, you know, when he went to the track, he started out his day with a 20-lap moto every day. And from the day we started testing or started Supercross, We did a total time of 20 laps the first day. And then, you know, every day thereafter when he would do 20 laps, we'd do a total time and start looking at, okay, well, lap 12, you made this mistake last time you did it, and this time you didn't make that mistake. Your total overall time was, you know, 4 seconds faster than, you know, the 20 lap you did 3 days ago or whatever. So,
yeah.
you know, we kind of looked at things like that, and, you know, he did the testing that he needed to. He really was a guy that felt what was going on with his bike. And if it was, and, you know, even if he found something a little bit better for him, he might be able to push a little bit harder. He's not going to put it on for a race until he's really comfortable with it, because he doesn't want to think about that when the gate drops.
Right.
He wants the bike to be predictable and know exactly what it's going to do in every situation. So you could find a sweet front tire,
mm-hmm.
but he's gonna go back to the, you know, old trusty one, because he knows when he gets in the sand it's gonna wash out. So he's ready for that.
Yeah.
You know, it's not gonna grab a rut and like pull him off to the inside of the corner or whatever. You know, it's just gonna do what he knows it's gonna do, and he was able to win that way.
Hence him running the same frame from 93 to 96. Rumor has it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, he. And again, motocross, it's the bottom line is, you know, you need to do that 20 laps as fast as you can on Saturday night. It doesn't matter what you're on. It doesn't matter how much you weigh.
Yeah.
Any of that stuff. You know, if you can do it, if that's what you can do it the best on, that's what you need to be on.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about those years at working for MC. So, talking about your career a little bit, you are you're a mechanic in the early days. Were you on NCY Yamaha? No, you weren't. What'd you do before you got into mountain biking? Who'd you work for?
Before I went into mountain biking, I worked for Mitch at Pro Circuit for David Pingree.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Yeah.
I worked with David Pingree the year before that when he was riding support for Suzuki.
Uh-huh.
And I was with Doug Dubach for 3 years at Yamaha before that.
That's maybe what I was thinking about, the Dubach years. Yeah. Yeah, it's cool. And then the whole time. So growing up, Phil was always the moto racer, or did you stick with it?
Phil was actually the younger brother that I would leave at home because he was too slow to come riding.
Really? Really? Yeah.
Yeah. He actually, once he finally was able to get a dirt bike,
mm-hmm.
He was either going to get an ATC or he was going to get a YZ80.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted an ATC 200X. They went down to the shop to get it because he finally got good grades, and he's like, "No, I'll just get the YV80.
Yeah.
So that was in 1984, and that's kind of when he started, you know, racing a little bit and started doing some things. And like, he was 80 novice or whatever. I was 125 intermediate at that point.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, I was just got pretty interested in like BMX, like the freestyle movement was starting, like the skate park ramps and all that stuff was going on. So, man, I want to do that. Like, that looks like a lot of fun. So I up and sold all my dirt bikes and stuff, and I started riding bicycles, and Phil just continued on with the moto stuff and kind of went forward from there.
Yeah, yeah. And then so you found your calling as a mechanic, quitting that, going downhill mountain biking racing, and then getting a call to be MC's mechanic in 98. He'd come off a little disastrous season for him on Suzuki's, but was it cool to get the job working for McGrath? I mean, was it what you thought? What was it like?
No, it was awesome because, you know, I knew McGrath since, you know, 87, 88, because he was racing, you know,
mm-hmm.
125 novice with my brother.
Right.
You know, they were kind of friends, and him and Rhino and Button and like all that, you know, that whole crew just kind of grew up together, raced together. And, you know, Jeremy was, you know, he'd won 4 Supercross championships already. And, you know, he went to Suzuki. He lost that one. You know, he got second. You know, people say that's a terrible year, but
yeah,
tell you what, if I finished second in the Supercross series, I'd be pretty happy about that.
And he was like a flat tire away from winning the whole thing.
Yeah, so, you know, he kind of had a, you know, a sour taste in his mouth from losing that one and the way it happened. And, you know, he kind of got misguided a little bit and maybe lost interest and started, you know, maybe going down the wrong path for a little bit in that season. And he wanted to make some changes. He wanted to do it right. You know, again, just like, you know, Jason was saying to me in January, just
mm-hmm.
wanted to do it right. He wanted to come back. He wanted to start training. He wanted to win races. And to be honest, he was kind of scared to go to Yamaha because he left Honda, which was the only place he'd ever been.
Right.
Who puts 110% effort into everything that they do for racing. And at that point, Suzuki wasn't the team that was putting that effort in. you know, to just be the best they could be, and testing every single piece on the bike every day to make it better.
Yeah.
Now, so he was kind of skeptical, like, well, why would I go to Yamaha? Why wouldn't I go back to Honda, who does everything right? Well, I had been at Yamaha with Dubok, and I assured him, you know, between Keith and Guerra and, you know, John R., Bob Oliver, you know, the whole crew that was over there, Steve Butler, just everybody involved, they're going to put the time in, and they're going to give you a bike that you can win on. They're going to give you everything they got so that you can be successful. And that, you know, that kind of put ease in his mind a little bit. And between Larry and, you know, I knew Larry Brooks already, like, pretty well.
Right.
I knew Yamaha pretty well. I knew Jeremy pretty well. So if you look at that whole situation, I was kind of the center point of that group, putting the first really, really high-end satellite team together.
Right.
And
yeah, it certainly at the time was a little weird. Like, Jeremy is going to ride for Chaparral Yamaha? What?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. It was kind of a weird thing. And you know, ultimately, it actually brought Yamaha their first 250 championship in 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that was a pretty big milestone for satellite teams and putting things together like that. So it was awesome. Like, you know, three years with Jeremy, 98, 99, 2000, three championships, you know, like 25 Supercross race wins.
Yeah.
His last outdoor national win at Hangtown, you know, before he stopped riding nationals.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And
it's a lot of.
One of the good moto fan questions is what would happen if he had not broken his wrist at Mount Morris, you know? Like,
he didn't break his wrist at Mount Morris. He broke his wrist at Pontiac when he crashed and he broke his handlebars off that night.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that. So was when he first started hurt his wrist.
Yeah. So he finished out the Supercross series, you know, in a little bit of pain and dug in and was able to, you know, win the races he needed to and finish where he needed to win that title. And then he was going to kind of get in and go for it in the outdoors. And, you know, he did Glen Helen and did pretty good there. Went 1-4 and ended up with a third or something, like, because Albertine went 4-1 or Tortelli went 4-1 or something. And then, he won Hangtown. Like, he wore purple gear because he knew if he wore that purple gear, he would have to win. So he won that win. And then he went to Mount Morris and got a fifth, and he was pretty bummed out, you know, because his wrist was hurt and he wasn't able to push like he needed to. And then he just bowed out after that. So
yeah, yeah. I guess when you're like MC, fifth isn't going to cut it back then, you know.
Yeah, fifth ain't going to cut it, man. I'm going to bow out. I'm going to get some surgery on the thing, get it fixed, and I'm going to come back next year. And he did.
Yeah,
you know, he won.
What do you think of when you think of those 3 years with him? Just success, just a lot of fun. Looking back,
you know, it was awesome because one of the reasons that we talked and worked into being his mechanic was he wanted somebody that knew how to do the job that was a friend of his that was kind of into the same things, and we both were into BMX bikes, and you know, we knew that we could have a good time together, you know, away from the racetrack. And that was what he was looking for. You know, he'd been there. He'd done that. And he's like, I want it to be a little bit more fun and not, like, just serious all the time.
Right.
And, you know, I feel like I brought that element to his program for him and was still there able to do the job and have the bike ready when he needed it there.
Right. Now, what kind of happened at the end there, RL? You what happened at the end of the MC days to you? You kind of went through a little rough spot, huh?
Yeah, I kind of went through a little rough spot there. You know, we got into the 2000 season. You know, he was winning races. And
mm-hmm.
The 3 years I worked with him, he won more races in 2000 than he did in 98 or 99. He ended up winning 10 races that season.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and my nights after the races were, you know, getting a little bit crazier, and I ended up making some bad decisions personally in my life and ended up, you know, in a divorce, and some things happened through that, and you know, Jeremy and those that were involved there felt that my personal life was going to interfere with what I was doing with him.
Mm-hmm.
And again, kind of like the Ryan thing, without very much communication at all with me,
yeah,
I get a phone call, you're not working for Jeremy anymore. And I'm like,
But okay. Looking back on it, I mean, was it affecting your job? Or do you still look? I mean, were you, did you think it was a little bit of a Chad Watts RC kind of deal? You know, one of those things?
It probably was affecting me a little bit. Like, I think this is kind of my take on it is, you know, once I thought about it a little bit, you know, Jeremy did a Supercross-only deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked for Chaparral. And the agreement was for me to work for Jeremy for Supercross.
Right.
Well, once Supercross was over, that's when I would go race mountain bikes in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there wasn't many other mechanics or industry people that were cool with that, especially the mechanics. They were kind of, I mean, obviously they were jealous. You know, me and Jeremy come to the races for, you know, 6 weekends. We win more than half the races.
Yeah.
And the next thing you know, we're on vacation.
Yes.
And they're still at work.
Yeah.
And we're the ones that, you know, got all the bonuses.
Yeah.
So there was some of that.
You mean guys at Yamaha, guys at Chaparral? Kind of, you know, is that what you mean?
Man, there's probably guys at Honda and Suzuki that were upset about it. You know, I mean, it was just pretty much all across the board. You know, it was,
right.
You know, but I felt that I did the job that I needed to do for Jeremy, what I was, you know, signed up to do. And once Supercross was over, I kind of took off. And that year was kind of when I was dealing with a lot of things personally, and maybe my communication and, you know, taking care of some of the loose ends after the season. Maybe I didn't do the way I should have.
Right.
Or as much as I should have. But, you know, again, it was, they just decided I didn't need to be there without any sort of communication, without even Jeremy calling me saying, hey, you know, we've had some success, you know, but you're kind of doing this and I'm not really digging it. We got to figure something out.
Really? Like no warnings, no nothing.
Yeah, there was no warnings. There was no anything, you know, kind of the same deal that I just dealt with Ryan last year. So,
right. Did you,
there's a couple.
So was the friendship strained? Was it pretty bad there around that point?
You know what? It did strain it a little bit at that time. I mean, enough to where, like, I saw the changes Jeremy made from 2000 to 2001 when he started preparing for Supercross again.
Yeah.
And instead of, like, being, you know, cool about it and being like, hey, you know what, you're my buddy. You know, you're maybe going a little bit in the wrong direction with this thing right here, like, I don't want to get into specifics, but I saw just some mistakes that I thought were gonna maybe not let him be the best that he was gonna be when he got to the races. When he came out, he won the first race. I was like, okay, well, that's cool.
Right.
But then next thing you know, he lost a couple, and then, you know, he's getting arm pump, and he's thinking, like, just, and then they start trying to figure the bike out. Like, something's wrong with the bike. We got to fix it.
Yeah. Well, I remember his gloves were too tight at one point. It was his gloves, you know. I mean, everybody was searching, you know. So
changing grips and just different things, and there were some things that I thought he was doing, like during the week, that probably maybe attributed to, you know, him not being 100% prepared to do what Jeremy had always done before.
Right.
So, just as an individual.
How are you guys now? You're fine? Everything's cool?
Yeah, we're fine now. Like, I mean, you know, when we see each other, we talk. It's not, I mean, you know, we don't hang out every Saturday, you know, and go to Star West and do some jumps or nothing. You know, we talk once in a while, and I'm like, hey, man, we need to get together, ride some BMX or whatever, you know, because I still ride quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, I mean, we don't really see each other that much.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I call him, you know, we'll talk. It's good. Obviously, no hard feelings at this point. Everything's, you know, kind of over and good. And you know, we were friends before I worked for him and went through a little rough patch right there when I didn't work for him. And we'll, you know, be friends and, you know, till the end of it.
Right.
So.
Right. I was just always jealous because you could pull big wheelies in the pits, up and down the pits. I thought that was pretty cool as a mechanic.
Yeah, that was my goal. Like, always just to do the best wheelies from one end of the pits to the other. You know, my daughter Raquel, she was 3 at that point, so if she was at the race, she was on the front when I was doing those wheelies.
I know, like, we'd be sitting there working, and all of a sudden you hear this barking, this bike that would just bark, you know, because that thing was gnarly back then. And
that had a little Bob Oliver in it.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's funny because when I went to work at Yamaha with Reedy, well, Reedy was on the two-stroke, but hey, his bike wasn't far off the golden years of MCs. It really was.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
It was probably a very, very similar cylinder.
Yeah, it was. It was, I think. And so I rode that thing a few times, and, man, you want to talk about some bottom end grunt.
Yeah.
But anyways, you'd hear this bark, and you'd look up, and there you are in your studded leather jacket pulling this massive fifth-gear wheelie, probably third-gear wheelie at the time. But I remember thinking, that guy's supercross only. Oh, jeez.
There's a little bit more of that jealousy.
Yeah. No, believe me.
That got me in trouble.
I wasn't complaining. I always thought, like, I didn't know you forever, but you were kind of like J-Bone to me, whereas the fact that, like, you and J-Bone were two of the, let's say, top mechanics in the sport, and both you guys had time for anybody. Do you know what I mean? Privateer mechanics or, you know, greasy Canadian mechanics like myself or whatever. That's what I always think of when I think of you. Like, I didn't know you, but, like, we spoke here and there. And I would be like, oh, this guy's going to be a dick because he's McGrath's mechanic. And you never were. Do you know what I mean? And same with J-Bone. Like, J-Bone never was a dick either. You know?
Yeah. So, well, me and J-Bone were really good friends, like, coming up. And, like, he would ride. I would ride a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
And then I started being, like, mechanic side of stuff more. And he was still trying to ride. And, you know, once we started moving up in the industry a little bit and, you know, getting a little bit better jobs, you know, you just saw that attitude that some of those top
mechanics did act like that.
It's like they wouldn't even hang out or talk to you, and, you know, it's like, come on, we're here working on dirt bikes. I mean, you know, it's fun, it's cool to do,
yeah,
but it doesn't make you like gnarly.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, you're exactly right. Some of those guys would act like they were literally better than you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
oh, yeah, for sure.
I remember thinking to myself, well, Lawrence and Albrecht are pretty cool. So, anyways, how long were you, so after MC and the whole deal there, how long were you out of the industry for before you came back at Cowie?
I left that side of the industry for about a year.
Oh, yeah.
I started just trying to regroup, kind of putting my life back together.
Uh-huh.
Got myself involved in church, changed my priorities around quite a bit. And it gave me, you know, a little over a year just to kind of regroup and get things going. And then I got a call from Ezra Lusk when he was leaving Honda and moving over to Kawasaki. And we kind of hooked up and ended up going over there.
Yeah. And how was that? Talk about that, working with Yogi at Cowie.
You know, that was good. He was definitely a great guy to work with. You know, his personality, he was really cool, you know, super quiet, but really funny. Again, a hard worker, really wanted to do well. And just fast, like all-around fast guy, like good guy, you know, was super cool. We had a lot of fun together, and the first season that I worked with him was, again, you know, I was pretty stoked because it was the first season of Supercross and Outdoor, full every single race that he had finished, you know, since he started his career, without missing a race, and had they still ran, like, the Grand National numbers, like, you accumulated points for Supercross and Outdoors, you know, with the exception of Ricky, he would have been number two. You know, he earned more points than any other rider except for Ricky that season with the combined Supercross and Outdoor. And finishing, I think he finished third or fourth in the Outdoor Series that year with, like, three or four podiums. You know, I think it was a good year for him. Like, he had some good races. He had some podiums in Supercross, some podiums Outdoors.
Right.
Some good battles, you know, some bad races. You know, we worked through everything together. We did a lot of testing with the bike, and it was just a good time. You know, a lot of work, a lot of flying, a lot of races, but just a good guy to work for. And, you know, his wife was super nice, and then having their baby and being involved with him and his wife, and then his life at that point was cool.
Right.
You know, especially where I'd came from, you know, and I had changed all the priorities in my life and was 100% focused on, you know, getting my priorities right and making sure that my daughter was taken care of and things were going good for her, and then to be working with Ezra, who was, you know, a strong Christian also, and then he's starting his family. you know, just a lot of good things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was just
a cool atmosphere for sure. And you guys won Phoenix 03, so that was cool.
Yeah, that was awesome. What was funny is people are, because you got like eight at Anaheim 1, mm-hmm. and, you know, like 15 guys crashed, and if they hadn't crashed, like he didn't ride that great that night, he probably wouldn't have been in the top 10.
Right.
And then he wins the next race. So everybody's like, man, are you pretty shocked that you won the first race? And I was like, no, I was shocked at Anaheim 1 because the way he rode at Phoenix, that's how he rides every day.
Yeah.
You know, so I was shocked at Anaheim 1 when he didn't ride good. I was like, Phoenix, when he won, that was like a normal day.
Yeah, yeah. I know when I was around him at the end at Mach 1 Yamaha, there wasn't too many people that I seen day in and day out go faster in practice and also crash really hard. Do you know what I mean? Like, that guy put a lot of 100% effort into every practice session, I think. Was he like that at Cowie?
Oh, yeah. Every time. Every time he was on the track, he was just...
Yeah, there was no cruising. You know, there was no half easy days. It was he's going to go all out, and then he's going to crash and bend some bars, and as soon as you change those bars, he's going to go back out and go all out again. You know?
And again, like, I mean, I learned so much from him, his riding style, mentally, personally, you know, things that I use that I apply to riders that I work with now.
Did you? Yeah, really? Oh, that's cool. I did one of these with him, and it was so interesting, so fascinating. What a cool guy, you know? Just real introspective and went into great detail about him and Ricky and him and his parents and all that. It was a really good show. More respect for Ezra after doing that. So
yeah.
And then what made you? How'd you like working at Cowie? You liked all those guys. Everything
Cowie
was cool.
Cowie was awesome.
Yeah.
Cowie was like, you know, I mean, I really enjoyed working at Yamaha when I worked there for Jeremy and even for Dubok in the early 90s.
What about Damron? How'd you like Dave Damron?
Dave Damron, you know, he was a good boss. You know, he for sure was the boss. he was the boss. You know, he hired you to do a job. And he wanted you to do that job. If you did your job, then he was fine.
Yeah.
You know, we had a good relationship. I felt that I did my job for Jeremy that I needed to do. And when he let races or come in, you know, we were good.
I know.
And Jeremy was winning races, so you know, maybe we had a little bit better than some of the other guys.
Yeah. Yeah, you had it like better than say me. You know.
Yeah, I probably had a little better than you. Your guy was probably struggling a little bit. And
but yeah,
here we are with leather jackets and winning races. So
I know, studded leather jackets, pulling wheelies, winning races. Was Bruce at Cowie? Was he the manager?
Bruce was the manager at Cowie when I went there.
There's a great guy right there, Bruce Sternstrom. Great guy.
It was cool. Like, we had a lot of fun, and you know, they weren't super strict. You know, I mean, you know, they were strict to the point where, you know, you need to do your job. You know, they allowed me to help with, you know, little development things, like, mm-hmm. if there were little things I saw with the bike, you know, they would be involved. You know, with Norm Bigelow, like, he was just, he's into it. Like, he's going to fix everything that ever is wrong.
Right.
It was just cool. Like, it was a really cool working atmosphere, and I had a good time at Kawasaki when I was there. It was cool.
Right, right. What made you decide to hang up the wrenches and get into training? With me, to be honest, wrenching just got kind of old. I mean, it just got to be repetitive, and I couldn't be a trainer, so I went into the riding thing. But what made you decide to do it?
I don't even think it was the mechanic stuff that got old for me. I mean, I still enjoyed it, you know. I still had a good time, you know, as long as Alex Ewing was watching me change a tire, I had fun doing it. But anyway, like, I just saw that there was a lot of amateur kids coming up, and, you know, there was riders in the industry that, you know, I saw they were just missing little bits and pieces of their program. And,
right.
You know, it had been, you know, 10 years since box vans were gone and there were semis, and, you know, at the point I was at Kawasaki, the rider is just completely detached from their mechanic. And
wow.
I always,
yeah.
One of the best parts for me was being involved with my riders. You know, when I worked with Jeremy.
Yeah.
You know, I went to the test track with him pretty much every day. You know, I was with him when he was doing his other training. You know, we were at the BMX track together doing sprints or whatever.
you know, I was a part of what he was doing.
Yeah.
And I felt that a lot of that was gone, and I felt that I had something to offer, you know, kids that are coming up, and whether they're amateurs or just turning pro or you know, even riding the premier class, just from all the experiences I'd had, you know, working in the industry and, you know, with the training techniques that I'd developed and learned about, you know, on my own. So I waited till we bought a house, and my wife was pregnant with Riley, who's our four-year-old now, and I decided to quit my job and start my own business.
Of course, perfect. Brand new house and pregnant wife. That's so funny that you say that, because I, you know, obviously in 99, I worked with Red, and we got top privateer of the year and did, you know, then got on the Chaparral team. And in 02, I worked with Nick, top privateer, and, like, drove the series in a box van and, you know, stayed with him back east. And, you know, and when I got to Yamaha with Timmy again in 03, I was kind of bummed out for the same reasons. I was like, what? I don't get to go to the track? I got to stay here? Like, and then, you know, Timmy had hired a trainer, you know, one of you guys, and he had Tishner around, and he had a suspension guy and a motor guy, and I started feeling like, wait a minute here. Like, I got some stuff to offer, too. It kind of bummed me out in the direction that it was going, and definitely the direction it is right now in the sport today is, you know, the mechanics stay with the team. The riders rotate, and that didn't used to be like that.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
So that kind of bummed me out, too. That's funny you brought that up. I was the same way. I was like, this isn't as much fun when you're not around your friend, who, I mean, Timmy was my friend, you know, so I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think some of the industry is trying to take that away. They want it to be more impersonal. And
they do, right? They totally do. Yeah. Like,
and because if friends work together, you know, there could be conflict at some point, and then that's not good. But,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
But I think there's a lot of benefits to it, too. So
yeah, the whole Ramsey-Bundy thing isn't going to happen anymore. You know what I mean?
No, that is not
going to happen in this day and age. Neither is driving to all the races, I guess. Before I let you go, for anybody, for any amateur motocrossers listening out there or vet racers listening, what's a few things they can do to improve their shape for motocross right away? Like, you know, somebody who's got a job full time or whatever, what kind of stuff would you recommend to them off the bat?
Off the bat, just moderately, you know, maybe if they can do some spin classes or something at the gym that would kind of bump up their heart rate a little bit, you know, make them breathe a little bit harder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to get a little bit of leg strength out of that, too, just by pushing the pedals a little bit harder and, you know, try not to stand up when you're doing it. Do some of that. You know, obviously, what I try to do with my guys is, like, focus on, like, the shoulder-chest area, because that's, you know, crucial for motocross. You know, when you crash, you know, popping shoulders and things like that are common. So if you have a little bit of strength around there, that's gonna help you. So, I mean, if you're working and just trying to ride and race on the weekends, you know, doing those couple things at the gym, obviously doing intervals, trying to get your heart rate up and down, and you know, those spin classes to push hard on the pedals and things like that, that's going to help. You know, even playing racquetball, swimming a little bit, just kind of mixing up the gym and just having fun. And you know, as long as you're breathing hard and, you know, harder than, you know, getting out of your comfort zone a little bit, it's going to help you when you get to the track.
Right. And that's something that anybody can do at any time, be it amateur or vet rider or whatever, huh?
Yep, absolutely, for sure.
Well, cool, man. Well, hey, this has been fun. Thanks for doing it.
Yeah, no problem. It's my pleasure. We could probably go another 2 or 3 hours if you wanted to.
We could easily go another 2 or 3 hours. No doubt about that. I got a lot more questions about a lot more things, but
we've been an hour and a half and I haven't got myself in trouble yet.
No, I know. You've been good. There could be some things that we need to talk about in the horizon, maybe.
All right, we'll see how this one goes, and then I will maybe dip in a little bit farther if we need to.
Yeah, there we go. All right, RL, you gonna be there this weekend? Toronto?
Don't think I'm gonna make it to Toronto.
No, okay.
No, and I think I'm gonna sit out the Canadian round.
That's a real bummer. I mean, I don't know if you know this or not, but I'm going in early.
You're probably going to go in early. I think I'm going to stay home, and me and my wife are going to have our 7th wedding anniversary this Sunday.
Seven.
Perfect timing. Seven. Yeah, I get to miss a Canadian round, and that's my anniversary. So I get two bonuses there for me.
Let me tell you, buddy.
Now I'm starting to get myself in trouble, so I better get going.
Yeah, yeah. Taking her to Canada for your seventh anniversary, there'd be nothing better. Nothing better. That you could take her to the Hockey Hall of Fame. There's a lot of things you could do. But that's just me. All right, RL. Well, thank you for the great podcast, and I'm sure I will see you down the road. And this has been the BTOsports.com Transworld Motocross Podcast Show. Thanks, RL.
All right. Thanks, Steve. Talk to you later.
See ya.
Bye.
This has been the BTOsports.com Podcast Show, brought to you by Transworld Motocross. Don't forget to check out some of our past shows, including motocross legends such as
The Beast from the East, Damon Bradshaw.
It got to the point where I didn't want to leave home, and once I got to the race, I wasn't into it. If I wasn't going to give 100%, I'm not going to take their money.
The working class hero, Doug Henry.
It was definitely an emotional moment for me, just thinking to myself, that's it, you know, and it's amazing the stuff that goes through your head in a short amount of time of the things that, you know, that I was going to miss.
The Dogger, Ron Machine.
Until you really open your ears and you want to listen to what they're saying, it's like beating a dead horse. I mean, you know, and I know from personal experience, did anybody ever sit me down? Of course they did. Everybody did.
Pro Circuits, Mitch Payton.
There's two ways to make the money. One is you can sign for money, or two, you can earn the money. I'm a high believer in earning the money. I think they ride better when they earn the money.
Seven-time Jeremy McGrath.
I was so mad, like so disappointed and so frustrated that I had pulled the pick and I left. Every point counts. I could kick myself to this day for not just riding around in tents. It's been no problem. My ego got in the way, you know?
The O Show, Johnny O'Mara.
Stuff that you'd sit there if you didn't even want to ride it, you just wanted to just look at it all day. I mean, I got a chance to test all that. I like that era I was in. I really do.
Search Mathis on the iTunes Store to find these and many more great podcasts. I won't let this die. You know I've got this bad up in the atmosphere. Another reason not to fear this.